I'd like to welcome you to session 361, The Search for Divine. Phyllis Barber will be presenting. Before we get started, let me remind you to turn off your cell phones and your noise makers, and please don't slam the door when you leave. We're really delighted to have Phyllis present today, and many of you know Phyllis and acquainted with her work. She's the author of a number of books and has a new memoir coming out soon to be published by the University of Nevada Press. So that's in the fall of 2009, is that right? So we'll look forward to that. She has taught at the Vermont College MFA in writing program for 17 years, served on the fellowship panel for the National Endowments for the Art, and was recently inducted in the Nevada Writers Hall of Fame. Lives in Denver, Colorado, near to her three sons, their wives, and their fabulous grandchildren. It sounds like my wife, who thinks she's the only person in the world who has grandchildren. And she doesn't appreciate it when I tell her. We're looking forward to Phyllis's presentation, and so join me in welcoming her, please.
Thank you for being here today. It's so great to see you all and to be with you and share my writing, which we spend many hours all by ourselves doing. So I wanted to begin with speaking about, I went to the Aspen Writers Conference last June, and there was a literary festival with a lot of Indian writers from India, and Salman Rushdie was there, and he was a keynote speaker. But they had a panel about My India, and each person spoke about their experience of India. Each was from India and now lived in the United States. But each started speaking of their experience of India and how it was very different and how it was very much the same. Can you hear me all right? Better? I have a soft voice. So anyway, after I heard them speaking about their India, my India, I walked out of there and I thought, that's a really nice way to consider Mormonism, my Mormonism, rather than just Mormonism in general. And I have a great affection for Mormonism, and I also gain a great deal from other cultures. And when I was away from the church for about 20 years, I went to a lot of different churches and a lot of different experiences, always looking to see how people connected with the divine. So, I have written some essays around this very fact. So I'm going to read from, I should just read you one whole one, but I'm going to read pieces of two essays. And this one is called Three Monks. A week after arriving in India and 3 days before traveling over the rough roads to Sikkim, I'd been ordered to take a 3-day bed rest, diagnosed with Delhi belly, dehydration, high fever. On the final morning at the Cedar Inn in Darjeeling, my roommate Leslie and I had risen early to watch the sunrise on Kanchenjunga, the third highest mountain in the world. It could only be seen, however, when the clouds would allow. As we waited, I read to her from yet another page in a travel guide. Sikkimese Buddhism combines Tibetan Buddhism with elements of the Aboriginal Lepcha religion, the most striking example being the incorporation of the worship of Kanchenjunga. After the first climb was made to the top of Kanchenjunga in 1955 by a team of British mountaineers who stopped a few meters short of the summit in deference to the wishes of the Sikkim king, the Buddhist monks prayed that any subsequent attempts would fail. Their sacred mountain should not be violated. The Lepchas called it Curtains of the Snows and worshipped it with the annual Podlotsol dances. The next expedition did fail. Miserably, and with respect for the Buddha's sacred mountain, subsequent climbs were forbidden. Leslie and I had ordered breakfast tea that morning and were sitting in front of the window to keep constant surveillance on the clouds that rose, drifted, floated, yet veiled the horizon. After an hour of sitting, the clouds momentarily thinned and parted to reveal a breathtaking, throaty glimpse of the snow-cloaked mountains, a tease. But just as suddenly, they crowded over me. This was nature's fan dance. Now you see it, now you don't. Sikkim. When my friend Shirley Smith, who organizes adventure tours around the world, called 6 months earlier and asked if I wanted to go to Sikkim for an 8-day trek in the Himalayan foothills, I told her I'd call back. I found my Oxford World Atlas and traced two fingers across a grid to discover the country's whereabouts. The place was tiny, a pinprick on the map. In 1975, this small country tucked between Nepal and Bhutan, not all citizens willing, had become the 22nd state of India, mainly because of the desirability of its lengthy border with Tibet, thus China. I dialed Shirley back. I want to go, but my knee's acting up. See what you can do, she said. For weeks filled with rooster comb shots for the knee and exercises at the gym, I vacillated between my desire for adventure, my need to detach from notions of invincibility, and my deep wish to unearth the divine wherever I could. In Sikkim, a traveler's guide by Arundhati Ray and Sujoy Das, I read about the original Sikkimese known as Lepcha and how the origins of the language remain shrouded in mystery, about the wide range of tropical, temperate, and alpine zones, about Kanchenjunga, which was only 100 feet shy of Everest's summit. But there was a particularly stunning sentence that sealed my fate, quote, "In a land where stars are thought to be the laughter of gods frozen for eternity on the face of heaven, myths and legends are central to everyday life and permeate the daily existence of the people," end quote. I was smitten. However, 1 week before departure day, while hiking in Utah, I slipped on a slimy moss-covered rock near a stream bed and literally flipped upside down to faceplant on another large rock. This 63-year-old, ordinarily graceful, woman of strength literally fell on her face. My blood covered the ground like water, and at the emergency center in Park City, my nose was deemed fractured. The doctor resorted to a medieval torture device screwed up into one's sinuses to stop both the external and internal bleeding. I screamed, shameless, sure this was a sign to stay home and accept my lot in life. But what about my trip, my full unreturnable deposit, and especially my desire to observe Tibetan Buddhism firsthand? The next day, I asked the ENT doctor about the wisdom of proceeding. He said I could still go if I really wanted to go. "You can breathe, can't you?" he asked with a smirk on his face. "I'll re-break your nose when you return and fix it up just fine." Therefore, I refused to accept this as a bad omen. Everything is impermanent, the Buddhists were famous for saying. I would go, crooked nose and all, forget consequences. Maybe I suspected I was impermanent, though I didn't realize how little I accepted that fact. Even before our group arrived in India, Delhi being our first stop, I decided to do only 2 days of the 8-day trek, my knee too iffy. But the first day is a very rugged 10 miles. Namgyal, our guide, told me on the eve of our trek's beginning, "You haven't eaten anything for 3 days." He eyed me carefully, respectfully, and I self-consciously remembered the remnants of my black eye and the weird crook in my nose. When the first cock crowed in Uksum, a small village in western Sikkim, on the morning of the group's departure, I tiptoed past my sleeping roommate on legs that felt like rubber bands. I sat on the balcony to read from Chogyam Trungpa's Shambhala, the Sacred Path of the Warrior. Quote, "The vision of the great eastern sun is based on celebrating life. It is contrasted to the setting sun, the sun that is going down and dissolving into darkness. The setting sun point of view is based on fear. We are constantly afraid of ourselves." I decided to dress. I pressed through my resistance. I wouldn't stay behind, though after discussing my plans with Shirley, she suggested trying half day in and half day out. A guide's already been hired to take you back when you need to return, so you can't lose. Our group of nine posed for a group picture and then threaded through the village with its chickens, goats, and its magical stupa near a peaceful lake with prayer flags stationed everywhere. We hooked up with the trail and into the Kanchenjunga National Park, where the terrain turned major league. Facing the deep escarpments and unforgiving steepness, the group climbed steadily towards Ongwe, Dangsing, Samidi Lake, Kochela, and Shoka. Sikkim was known as the Valley of Butterflies, and everywhere there were exotic ones I'd never seen before. After 2 miles, however, I was perspiring as I'd never perspired before, a woman beneath a running showerhead. One of our group, a seasoned bicycle tour guide, gave me a penetrating, even wilting look. "You're asking too much of your body," she said gently, yet firmly. "You need to go back." "No," was my first response, though the usual, I'll be okay, give me a minute, didn't automatically pop out of my mouth. I think not, her final remark left no room for argument. As much as I didn't want to agree, as much as I stared up the trail and envisioned myself trudging ever onward, strong mountain woman I visualized myself being, I relented. My idea of trekking for 2 days, even one, had shrunk to a few hours. For a moment I battled with the thought of mortality and the perished the thought of being old. Oldness happens when you give up, and I was still convinced I could do it all. However, the reality of the Himalayan foothills stared at me stone cold, full on. They were like nothing I'd ever experienced before. Major, major league. I asked my boutique guide if he'd wait while I sat on the bridge. He was agreeable. I gazed at the treacherous rocks and tumbling mountain stream below. I will not go gently into that dark night, I whispered, jabbing at tears. I will not go gently. I'd taken on many things, birthing 4 sons, marrying and divorcing 2 husbands and remaining friends with both of them, belly dancing, clicking the staccato heels of flamenco shoes, rock climbing on my 50th birthday, hiking the Grand Canyon, bicycling from Colorado to Illinois. This, however, was something else. Okay, I just skipped a lot. 4 days later, a driver delivers me to Runtek, a large monastery near Gangtok in eastern Sikkim. I haven't regained my health or my strength, and today I'm climbing the hill to Runtek for another lesson with Sherab, the 4'10" monk from Bhutan, my teacher for 4 days. I fight with a little white terrier of self-pity, nipping at my heels, and sense I'm approaching that place of erasure where fear will be greater than the sum of my parts. I'm afraid of my body, which isn't getting better. It sucks to be operating on substandard power. I'm used to high energy, and I despise this weakness. I wander through the maroon, ochre, and dark blue gate, complete with armed guards, into the inner courtyard. I stand as if dazed and confused, absorbing the stairs leading to the Dharma Chakra Center, the colors, the monks in maroon robes, the carved pillars, the hanging tankas, the Indian tourists pushing into every open door. What am I doing here? I'm immobilized, tar. I have no will or ability to move, and yet everything is swirling around me. Where did I ever get the notion I could understand anything? Why have I come here, and where did this arrogance arise in me, thinking I could discover something about God? I need my mother, though she's long gone. I can't go on. Suddenly, I feel a tugging on my left hand. I look down at a young boy, a lama about 8 years old who has appeared out of nowhere. He's pulling my arm. He's saying, "Come." I take hold of this man-child's hand as he leads me to a set of narrow stairs. We climb to the second story and follow the balcony walk to the Tara Temple, a place I visited briefly on my first day whirlwind tour with Tashi, my contact at the monastery. Taking no apparent notice of my arrival, Shenfen Dawa, Shenfen meaning to benefit others, and Dawa meaning the moon, a monk to whom I've been briefly introduced when I first arrived, is chanting with his prayer beads, striking the drum intermittently, then blowing on a battered tambour. Lost in ritual, he doesn't look in my direction or acknowledge my presence in any way. No matter. I sink to the parquet floor in relief and climb out of the straps of my backpack. I gaze at 2 large statues of the green and white terrace, the female aspects of Buddha, compassion, and the surround of miniature statues of Tara in glass-covered cases filling the walls. I count 108 of them as tears fill my eyes. Shelter. I've been granted shelter. My young guide takes his seat on a floor cushion next to where I sit. Like any boy, he fidgets and yet responds immediately when asked to perform any function at the altar. When Shenfen Dawa isn't using the gooseneck drumstick, the boy traces its curved neck with his finger, then pretends to be a drummer without touching the drum. I assess the alien objects in front of me, copper bowls lined in a row and butter lamps on the altar in front of the terrace everywhere, the dorje, the bell, the yellow roses with orange tops carved from butter, a plate full of rubies. I'm reminded of an exhibit at the Denver Art Museum of a host of headless Buddhas. Above the empty shoulders, different doll heads are hung on strings. Wolverine, Howdy Doody, a little rascal. and I'm thinking of the Greek, Roman, and Norse gods, the numerous deities of Hinduism, the monolithic god of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. How can any human understand the true face of good and evil? Why should I be so bent on being a spiritual seeker when maybe an answer is only a chip of dried paint beneath a fingernail? I've so wanted to know, and yet as I sit here, I know I don't know. Except, as I say that, I know that I do know. I'm living the Tao as I sit here, calming the rising water inside me, struggling with my human body, my backpack on the floor, listening to the sounds of Shenpen Dawa counting his prayer beads before I make my way to my appointed teaching hour. As I stand to leave, I bow to the two lamas and the 110 Teras and leave an offering on the altar. In my heart, I thank Tara, the boy, God, whomever has brought me to this place for a respite from my weariness. Backing out the door, I bow once again to Shenpen Dawa, who is still chanting, and to his young assistant, children, both of them. Children chanting, performing rituals, doing their duty for all sentient beings. Okay, this is based on experience in South Carolina, a little closer to home. And it was at a point where I was just facing a divorce from a second, very brief second marriage, and I was very despairing about that. So that's the setting in which this happens. I didn't hit anybody in the eye. Okay, this is from an essay called Sweetgrass.
Painful experience. Thank you for, that is our direct link to our Mother in Heaven. Each other, these beautiful feminine, strong hands. And every woman's hands, you start looking at these hands that have served so much. They are fun. With their hangnails and their peach stained cuticles.
Thank you, Bill.
And I felt that it was just beautiful writing. I really enjoyed it. Truly a work of art. And coming down to the mundane in our own culture, where are some of the places that you feel like you feel the divine in Mormonism?
Thank you. I actually I have a collection of 9 essays in this book, 6 of which have been written. One's called At the Cannery. and that was one of the first places. I did return to the church about 4.5 years ago. And the serving at the cannery made me feel, I didn't have any argument with that. I felt like I was helping people and wasn't asked to say something that I didn't feel. So that's, again, serving, helping feed people. So I find it there. I find it in the music. I find it in the community, how people will once in a while break through the barriers and reach out and put their arms around your shoulders. And that's one thing I like as I've returned to the church is as marginal as I feel sometimes, I feel really this is my community. And if something happened to me, they'd be there. And maybe it takes getting older. So that's where I feel it. And I mean, in the kindness of people, there's some wonderful people who do truly, truly live Christian lives and reach out.
I'm Phyllis's brother, and 4 years younger than she. And when I was younger, and Phyllis would play the piano in our home, I just felt I didn't have to go out searching for the divine. I was feeling it, and I just want to thank you.
Thank you.
My question is somewhat similar. I know you have been musical and reached a high degree of proficiency. And my question is how have you found, or to be specific, how have you found the divine in either your musical expression or the musical expression of others?
Every once in a while you break through, and that's the best I can say. You've got me singing with a group of people, and all of a sudden you all come together. It's like the waves. Virginia Woolf wrote a wonderful book called The Waves, which come together, and then you disperse. So to me, it's that time where we do come together, and then we disperse again. And I have found that in music, that every once in a while it pops up, and it's so exquisite. And I think music is the best language myself. I wish I didn't have to use words sometimes. The first shaman I met with was in Peru, and his name was Teo, and his father started the first medical clinic in Cusco. He trained his daughter in Western medicine, and he trained his son in shamanic medicine so that they could serve the entire community. Teo was wonderful. I met with him for a week. I was with a group of women, and he told us we could try something called ayahuasca, which is like peyote, I guess, in there. Anyway, I had written an essay about this experience. Ayahuasca is called the talking vine, and I wouldn't recommend it to anybody out of context, and I'm not going to do it again, but I felt like that it was an incredible experience. It's called the talking vine, and Teo said this is the way the plants can speak to you and tell you what they need to tell you. So in my experience, I felt like I was right on the next to the earth, about this high off the earth, actually in the body of a snake, which sounds really weird. But I gained a real appreciation for that level of being in that experience. So and it made me feel more in one with the whole world around me. And then we flew into Ecuador in the jungle. And I had an opportunity to try that again, which I did not, because I felt one experience was sufficient and very powerful. And I'll just tell you that this short, I always say short because I'm so tall, but this short man came up and asked me to dance. We had a performance from the tribe of their tribal ways. And anyway, after that was over, they played some Peruvian kind of music, and then this short little man came up and asked me to dance, and he told us not to look in the eyes of the people, of the men, because that meant we wanted to go to the jungle with them. So I look people directly in the eyes, so anyway, I danced with him the whole time, looking at the ground, and it was very uncomfortable and not much fun. So he came up and asked me to dance again, so I didn't look him in the eyes, but I taught him kind of a game, like, you know, something like that, and oh, he laughed, we had the best time. And after this happened, our guide came up, she said, "Do you know who you were dancing with?" And I said, "No, I'm this guy from the tribe." And she said, "Well, that's the most powerful shaman in the Miazal jungle in Ecuador." But anyway, the next day, I was telling the interpreter that I appreciated the dance with. His name was Tonk, and he said, "Well, Tom was just saying how much he appreciated the dance with you." But what I got out of that, I wrote an essay about that, is dancing with the sacred. If we revere it and put that up on a pedestal, then we somehow can't be one with the sacred. So I was glad I didn't know he was the most powerful shaman in the jungle. Okay, any other questions? Oh, here. Another Phyllis.
I too very often feel like when I need comfort and when I say prayers, that there's nothing there. And seeking the divine has been a major motivation in my life. I do it mostly through reading. And as Frances Winlow told us yesterday, from Ecclesiastes, there is a time for everything under heaven, a time to close the book and get off your butt. But sometimes we find it in the most unlikely places. My father recently died and I had to go back east, and returning here for the funeral, I had an unexpected change of airlines. It cost me quite a bit of money. There was a stopover in Cleveland that we had to take a shuttle from one terminal to another. And I sat there in this shuttle and looked around at everyone, and they were just beautiful. And I'm thinking, don't they see this? Mm-hmm. Of course, they were all in their own little worlds, but sometimes all it takes is to expand your awareness to whatever's going on around you.
Thank you. That's really true. I was just always reminded, and I don't know if these are folk tales or whatever, but how you hear about the mysterious stranger that would show up Anyway, the people who show up and they are really Jesus in disguise. So that was a big factor in my growing up days, how you never know who you're looking at. It might be God, it might be Jesus, it might be whatever. So that's been my mystical way of dealing with life, in a very content one. It gives me lots of strength. Any more questions? Okay.
It's just been a little bit, I missed the very
beginning. I hope so. I have 6 essays of 9 written. One's about being with a Baptist preacher in a congregation in Arkansas, and having been asked to lead the choir, and saying, I can't do that. And they said, no, wait, he asked me to play the piano for the congregational singing. I said, I don't know your style. And he said, well, you can lead the choir, can't you? So I couldn't say no at that point, but had a very interesting experience there. And the one in a couple of ones in India, anyway. And one called At the Cannery, from the Mormon experience. So I'm going to mix them up. I hope to make it a book that I can put out for a larger audience, because I think it's time that the way we see the world as Mormons is not the way we're always seen, you know, as FLDS or whatever. I think it's a very rich culture that doesn't get seen out there very well. After this second divorce, I was pretty decimated, and so I went and healed myself over in Denver, where my children and my first husband live, and then I came back and lived in a little house next to Belle Clough, who's here. And one day Belle called me and she said, would you like to sing in the choir? And I said, well, it'd been about a year since I'd lived in the neighborhood. And I said, well, I like to sing. And I was feeling kind of lonely on that day. So we went and we sang in the choir. Well, then they announced that we had to sing at church that day. And it was just the hardest thing in the world to walk into that sacrament meeting, because you're all alone and divorced twice. I felt like pretty, you know, raw meat. And so I walked in and I sat up there in the front, and I just started to weep, because that kid couldn't deal with it. And right at that moment, this gentleman came over, and he introduced himself so kindly to me and said, we're glad you're here. And for some reason, I was open to receiving that kindness. And so I thought, well, I can respond to the church on that level. You know, I don't have to know if everything about it is true, but I love people's kindness to each other. So I started, and this man became my home teacher, he and his wife, and they were really very kind to me, and happened to be President Hinckley's daughter. And so I was, of course, like, whoa, President Hinckley's daughter's coming to my door. So, and they were very, very kind to me. So.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I love music. Big sub for music. Thank you for being here today. It's been lovely. Okay.
Well, let me just be bold here for a moment and introduce you to a couple of people. I'll introduce you to David here and David there. Raise your hand, David, so you get the right David. Dave, the Davids and I and Phyllis were all at BYU together and very close, and we loved Phyllis then. Of course, we were pretty idealistic, and our lives did not go the way that our leaders told them they would. But it's a wonderful thing that we're back together again and reacquainting ourselves and sharing our experiences over the years and still loving Phyllis. And thank you so much for coming and joining with us and Phyllis sharing herself and her writing with us. So let's give her another applause.